Whereas philosophy is certainly not self-expression. And philosophy, of course, is argument. And you can say, well, is the conclusion true or is the argument valid?
Welcome to Five Questions, where we don't ask if the conclusion's true or the argument valid, but what they say about you. I'm your host, Kieran Setia. In each episode, I ask a philosopher five questions about themselves. There are two ground rules. One is that follow-ups are allowed. The other is that the question I'm about to ask doesn't count as one of the five. So could you introduce yourself, tell us a bit about who you are and what kind of philosophical work you do?
Sure. So my name is Helen Stewart. I am Professor of Philosophy of Mind and Action at the University of Leeds, where I've been now for, 13 years. Given my title, it won't surprise you to hear that I work mainly in the philosophy of mind and action, especially action, I think. I've always been very, very interested in the free will problem and in the sort of metaphysical side of it, which I think ultimately stems from ideas about what actions are, the ideas that actions, if they're real actions, ought to be ours, ought to be up to us, and the difficulties that view makes for certain visions that I think we tend to have of reality. So I've worked a lot on the free will problem, particularly with a view to opening it up a bit to the idea that we might not be the only things in the universe that have free will, or at least not the only earthly things that have free will, that, you know, animals too might have versions of the powers that we think of under that freedom umbrella. So that those really are my sorts of things. And connected with them, I suppose I've been interested in metaphysical issues to do with causation, the ontology of causation, so sort of categories like events and processes and states and things like that. And the idea of determinism, obviously, which is a big issue in the free will literature.
Can I follow up a little bit? I don't want to preempt the questions that try to connect your life with your work, but I'm going to ask one anyway, which is, in working on animals, non-human animals and their agency, are you fond of animals? Do you have pets? Is that something that has been a part of your life?
I do have a pet, but I would say it's not really out of a love of animals that I have grown very interested in them philosophically. It's more out of a general conviction that the picture of the universe that I think I really grew up with in philosophy, and well, not just philosophy, in life, you know, where there were we humans on the one hand, and then animals and plants and the rest of the inanimate universe kind of separate from all of that, basically working mechanically while we did something completely different. That always kind of seemed utterly preposterous to me as a picture of the way things were. And particularly when I was thinking about free will, where, you know, this idea that we were the only things that had it, I thought, no, you know, we're evolved. We're creatures that arose from other creatures that were simpler than ourselves, and there ought to be some continuities in the realm of action that haven't been respected by the philosophical treatment of free will. So it was really out of those sorts of thoughts rather than a particular love of animals that the philosophy developed. Although I ought to say I am an extremely avid bird watcher. I guess I've developed in later life a keenness on observing nature and an interest in nature that perhaps hasn't always been there. I think it's grown over the years and has come to be a bit more of an influence on my philosophical ideas and persona.
Well, then let me ask you the official Murdoch-inspired question one. So she begins each episode of the podcast telling us that philosophy is not self-expression, but she also wrote, "To do philosophy is to explore one's temperament, and yet at the same time to attempt to discover the truth." So would you say your temperament influences your philosophical work? And if so, how?
Yeah, I mean, this has actually been quite a difficult question for me to answer, mainly because I think trying to answer it has made me realize that I'm not completely sure quite how to identify what temperament I have. I started off by kind of thinking about what other people tend to say about me. And they use words, you know, like patient, calm, quiet, relaxed, peaceable, those sorts of words, which connect, I think, with the traditional so-called phlegmatic temperament. And I can see ways in which characteristics like that do influence, I don't know about my work so much as my kind of working habits. I mean, I think actually the influence insofar as there is one is probably a kind of negative one, which I wish wasn't there. I think being patient has made me maybe inclined to be a bit too patient also with myself. So I allow ideas a lot of gestation time. And sometimes, you know, by the time I've allowed them to gestate, someone else has already gone ahead and kind of written the paper that I would have written if I'd only got my act together. I think I often don't have that sense of urgency that sometimes propels other academics into swifter action. So, that's a problematic way in which those kinds of tendencies have impacted on my work. But I think kind of counteracting those tendencies in a more positive way, I am a fairly sort of glass half full kind of person most of the time, at least when it comes to my own kind of personal life, which makes me, I think, inclined to think that problems, including philosophical ones, have got solutions and that I might, if I think hard enough and long enough, be able to figure out what they are. So I rarely feel despairing or kind of depressed about philosophical work. And I think, you know, despair can be a much more debilitating obstacle to writing than the kind of mere slowness that that I think sometimes gets in the way of mine. But the other thing I thought might be relevant to this is a sort of aspect of myself which I think other people maybe don't know about as much as I know about it myself, you know, that I might keep a bit hidden. I think I'm actually a bit of a control freak. I was an older sibling, so I got very used, as older siblings do, to sort of organising my poor younger sister and making her play the games I wanted to play and so on. And I think that's given me a kind of a taste for a very independent style of doing philosophy. And it's actually a style that I don't really approve of intellectually, because I think it's sort of obvious that many heads are better than one when it comes to philosophical issues, as they are, you know, with respect to lots of other issues. And that, you know, things like talking extensively to other people, collaborating, submitting your ideas regularly to public scrutiny and so on, all those sorts of things can, you know, help you overcome your own blind spots and see the relevance of things you might not have considered at first, all that sort of thing. So I do sort of endorse and approve wholeheartedly of very kind of sociable and collaborative ways of working. But I actually find I find it difficult to bring myself to work in that way, because ultimately I think I am a bit of a control freak. I like to be in charge. I'm a bit too keen on kind of having things all my own way. So that's another more secret aspect of myself that, yeah, I think has influenced the way I tend to do philosophy.
It's funny that you list patience as an impediment. I think there's another Murdoch quote that I, if I'm remembering it correctly, she says, in philosophy, if you're not moving at a snail's pace, you're not moving at all, which I kind of like.
Oh, I love that.
Yeah, no, I think if I was going to, this is going to connect with the second question, because if I was going to name a trait that I wish I had more of as a philosopher, it would be patience, the kind of lack of the urgency to have problems solved. I think I often find dealing with philosophical problems sufficiently anxiety inducing that I need to have some kind of resolution quickly. And I feel like that gets in the way of really doing reflective philosophical work. So let me ask you that question. This is question two. Is there a trait you wish you had more of as a philosopher?
Yeah, I thought about this one. And I think the trait that I would like more of is a kind of resilience to criticism that I think some people have, that I think I lack. I think I've always been much too easily discouraged by kind of negative comments. And it's actually terribly, terribly important in our profession not to be like that. But, you know, after all these years of trying, I still haven't managed to alter myself really at all in that particular respect. I think it might partly be a gender issue. That's a sneaking suspicion I have, you know, that women are a bit more inclined to this problem than men, which particularly makes me hate the fact that I haven't really been able to do anything about it. I mean, just to give you an example of how crap I am in this respect, last summer I spent a massive amount of time working on a paper that I'd been invited to write for a special issue of a journal. And I spent a lot of time on it. There was lots of other stuff I could have been getting on with, but, you know, I'd agreed to the invitation. I felt a bit obligated to the editors. So I persevered with it. And it was an especially time-consuming article because it was not only on a topic I'd never written on, but on a topic where there was really very little literature that I could find, at least in the analytic tradition. It was on the topic of demeanour,
mm-hmm.
which, you know, is very little talked about. And I sent it in and I got horrible comments back. And I still haven't been able to bring myself to do anything with that paper, despite the fact that I spent such a lot of last summer on it. You know, it's now a year later. It's still kind of somewhere, you know, in the metaphorical bottom drawer. I don't think I will be getting it out for quite a long time. And, you know, I kind of despair of myself. I don't quite understand what happens. I mean, I feel like there's this kind of weird mix of childish fury and hurt intellectual pride and actually sort of genuinely shaken confidence, which takes over, and I seem to be just sort of incapable of responding like a proper adult. So resilience to criticism would definitely be the trait that I would like to have.
I mean, it was interesting to me that in answer to the first question about temperament, there was a lot of self-criticism. So you mentioned two things, patience and being a control freak, but both in the guise of negative aspects of your temperament that get in the way of, or that you don't approve of, the way in which they affect your philosophical work. So I wonder if that's also a feature of your temperament that on the one hand can be problematic, but that kind of reflectiveness also might play a role in one's philosophical work.
I think I'm fine at self-criticism, actually. I can handle that.
No, that's what, yeah. You seem to go in for it straight away. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I think I'm quite self-critical, but I'm also quite gentle with myself, I think, in probably a good way. You know, I'm quite kind to myself. And maybe people are better at dealing with criticism from others when they're kind of accustomed to being less kind with themselves than I am, because it's not such a shock, you know, if you're constantly facing the onslaught of your own kind of self-critique, then maybe it's not so dreadful when you find that others are criticizing you too. I think maybe I give myself a rather sheltered life on the criticism side. I do go in for it, but in a gentle way. And yeah, perhaps that's why it's a bit of a shock when others are more cruel.
Yeah, well, yeah, other people are a problem. That's definitely part of life. Yeah. So I don't know if this is going to involve criticism or other people, but question three is, what's your worst moment as a philosopher?
Yeah, I didn't have any trouble immediately knowing what the answer to this was. It was a time when I was giving a talk at a department that shall remain nameless. It was based on the paper that eventually became Fresh Starts, which I eventually gave to the Aristotelian Society in 2008. And I was trying the paper out before giving it to the Aristotelian Society. I think part of the problem was the nature of that paper. It's a kind of weird paper. I'd be the first to admit that. It develops a very unorthodox position. And it's also extremely speculative. It's a sort of couldn't things be this way kind of paper, if you know what I mean, instead of a things are like this kind of paper. It's a what about trying to think of things like this? Is there any reason why we shouldn't? Are there any arguments against? Doesn't it actually seem quite natural to think of things like this? And so I think it was a bit short on hard arguments, actually. But even so, I just wasn't prepared for the level of incredulity. The incredulity sort of slowly turned as the talk wore on into what I felt was actual hostility that the papers kind of seemed to engender in the particular audience that was there that day. And what's more, I could kind of feel this vibe amongst the audience, that there was a kind of solidarity amongst them that felt almost tribal. I felt like I could hear them muttering beneath their collective breath, "Who does this woman think she is, swanning in and giving us a paper without any proper arguments in it, and kind of casting aspersions on the philosophy of mind that we all know and love?" Yeah, so it really did feel absolutely dreadful. And even, you know, my attempts to lighten the mood with a few jokes fell completely flat, just stony ground. And then the icing on the cake, the absolute denouement of the whole thing, was that there was in the audience, there was this guy who had recently been visiting at the University of Leeds. And he'd given a paper in Leeds that actually hadn't been very well received. And on that occasion, that's to say the occasion of his talk in Leeds, I'd felt a bit anxious about what a pummeling he was getting. And I kind of weighed in to help him, you know. And so when I saw him there in the audience, I think, oh, thank God he's here. And when the chair called on him to ask his question, I was really expecting a bit of a lifeline. Somebody was going to offer a bit of support. But not only did he not offer me any support, you know, he joyfully joined in the general kind of festivities of steward bashing. It was an appalling, appalling occasion. I've never gone down that badly before or since. It was, a terrible experience. Definitely the worst moment I can recall.
Well, there are lots of things I could follow up on there, but I think you're providing a very smooth transition to question four, which is about your relationship to your philosophical views, because you described the Fresh Starts paper as a couldn't it be like this paper. And question four is, do you really believe your philosophical views?
Yeah, I do. Absolutely. I believe them. This made me remember something that John Hyman once said to me. He said, look, philosophy is all about arguments. You know, you offer an argument, and you want it to be as good as possible. And then your audience or your reader or whatever, they've got a choice. You know, they can either accept your conclusion or they can find fault with one of your premises or indeed, you know, tell you that they don't think the argument works, of course. But I remember thinking at the time, no, it really isn't all about the arguments for me. It's about the truth. You know, it's about the conclusions of those arguments. That's what I'm interested in. It's, you know, it's about trying to get at the way things actually are in whatever domain it is that you're interested in tackling. Of course, you know, I do think that arguments matter. They are our main tools in philosophy. They're our main tools for getting at the truth. But in my view, it's not the ultimate aim of philosophy just to sort of trot out the good arguments. The ultimate aim is to get the conclusions right. And I'm not sure how unusual I am in this respect as a philosopher. I expect it's very common, actually. But I'm usually motivated to write in the first place by a conviction, especially if I'm convinced that someone else is wrong, or maybe that everyone else is wrong, or that something's been misunderstood by almost everybody, or if only we could see things in this other way, we'd be able to solve all these problems. You know, I usually begin from some sort of gut feeling of that kind, and then I try to find the arguments that will get me there, that will make that view persuasive. And of course, there are dangers in that approach, because, you know, you've got to be careful about the source of your convictions. Sometimes the source can be, you know, one human foible or another. So I think you have to be prepared to think pretty hard about why you're so convinced before you get going. And of course, you know, writing and thinking themselves can kind of serve to unconvince you of the thing you thought you were convinced of in the first place. That quite often happens. But I think I would say that if one of my convictions ever does survive the writing process, then the result is definitely going to be something that I certainly believe in. You know, I'm not a philosophical game player. I believe my views, and I want other people to believe them as well.
It's interesting. I definitely connect with that, in that I usually, when I'm doing philosophy, start with the conclusion, and then it's mostly reverse engineering, and often not about how to come up with arguments that will persuade people exactly. Often the question is, why is that true? Like, why? I want an argument that not only could move someone, or maybe it's not even that important if it could move someone, but it somehow gives you the grounds or the explanation of why things have to be this way. And that's much less much less oriented towards coming up with arguments that force people to either accept what you say or find fault somehow with the irresistible force of your reasoning.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's right. I think I kind of accept as inevitable that, in fact, most of what I say and write is not going to persuade the vast majority of people who will be the audience for it, because they've just got, you know, different starting points that I'm never going to shift them from. But yeah, it's about making it clear, perhaps to yourself as much as anybody else, why things have to be the way that you're convinced they are, and perhaps bringing, you know, a handful of people who are prepared to go along with your starting points along with you. But yeah, I think that's right, that I don't expect usually that masses of people will be persuaded. I mean, I guess I'd be a bit disappointed if nobody was, I think you're right. It isn't mainly about persuasion.
Well, since we're running out of time, I'm going to turn to our final question. This is another Iris Murdoch quote. "It's always a significant question to ask about any philosopher," she wrote. "What is she afraid of?" So what are you afraid of?
Well, I think my answer to this is probably a predictable one, because I think it's something that many people are afraid of at the moment, which is, you know, the collapse of a large number of natural ecosystems, followed by the end of human civilization due to climate change. You know, that those are the worries that keep me up at night. I think partly I know more than lots of the people I tend to hang out with about what's happening in the natural world because of my hobby as a bird watcher, you know, than they do. I feel it brings me into contact with the fact of biodiversity loss, mass extinctions, you know, every weekend. When I go out to look at things, there's fewer greenfinches, there's fewer puffins this year, you know, there's everywhere you turn, you see the depletion of bird and animal life, plant life, butterfly life, you know, you name it, things are diminishing all around us. And I feel very, very conscious of the diminution. And I care very much about that in and of itself, but also, of course, the diminution of the natural world, I feel, is just a precursor to diminutions that are inevitable in the human world too. And that, I mean, I'm very afraid that we are too selfish, too stupid, too short-sighted, too kind of unable to deal with invisible enemies that act in a kind of gradual and dispersed sort of manner to be able to do the things we need to do to see off the threat. So that's what I'm afraid of. I mean, I don't know whether that's the question, what I'm afraid of, is significant in any way for the context of my work as a philosopher. I mean, I guess it has made me kind of opposed to, as I said in answer to the first question? You know, I do feel opposed to visions of humanity which fail to respect our status as part of the natural world. I don't like those views, and I feel they're pernicious. So perhaps that's helped motivate me to develop the sorts of views of agency and free will that I have done. I guess maybe it connects in that way.
Well, thank you, Helen. It's been really great to talk to you. And thank you so much for appearing on the podcast.
Well, thank you, Kieran. It has been so fun to think about the answers to these questions. And I hope I haven't revealed too much about myself inadvertently in agreeing to do it. It's a nerve-wracking thing to have to do. But I really have enjoyed it. Thank you.
That was Helen Stewart. She's professor of the philosophy of mind and action at Leeds University and the author of The Ontology of Mind and A Metaphysics for Freedom. Thanks for listening to Five Questions.